From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the tradition of male violence. We talk with Russell Banks about his new novel, Affliction, the story of two sons brought up by an abusive, alcoholic father. Banks says he wrote this book to help him understand the consequences of having been beaten by his father. Like Banks, Valerie Miner is from a working-class background. Coming up, Banks talks about the fiction of the working class. Rock historian Ed Ward listens back to the obscure original recordings of some now classic songs. And television critic David Bianculli reviews the new season of Wise Guy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. Panamanian General Manuel Noriega appeared on government television tonight, ending speculation that he might have been injured during an aborted coup. Troops loyal to Noriega recaptured military headquarters from rebel soldiers after a six-hour battle crushing the coup. Earlier today, the rebels claimed they seized and held the Defense Forces headquarters in downtown Panama City, but Noriega's forces climbed the roofs surrounding the buildings, threw hand grenades and fired mortars, as well as sniping at targets inside the compound. Noriega has defied U.S. efforts to oust him for 2 years and survived a coup attempt in March of 1988. President Bush today denied the U.S. was involved in today's action. The Soviet legislature today voted immediately to ban labor strikes in the next major industries. The legislature said it was acting to stabilize the economy after a series of walkouts caused serious disruptions in supplies of coal, steel, and other important industrial materials. NPR's Ann Cooper has more from Moscow.
The Supreme Soviet's anti-strike order stays in effect until the legislature approves a new law on strike, possibly later this month. The law is expected to set up new arbitration procedures designed to head off wildcat strikes, such as the ones that shut down coal fields throughout the country this summer. The Supreme Soviet also called on leaders of the Southern Republics of Armenia and Azerbaijan to immediately resolve a railroad blockade that's cut off deliveries of food, fuel, and other goods into Armenia for several weeks. The legislature said Army and Interior Ministry troops would be sent in if the blockade isn't broken, but it gave no deadline for action. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
There's another exodus of East Germans tonight from the Bonn Embassy in Prague. The East German government agreed to allow up to 11,000 East Germans to leave. NPR's Deborah Amos has more from Prague.
The announcement came a few hours ago to the relief of the thousands of East Germans who were prepared to camp out in the cold in front of the West German embassy tonight. The embassy doors closed a number of times today. Those lucky enough to get in hung out of the windows. The doors opened every few hours to let in children. Baby carriages were passed over the heads of the crowd to the embassy's front door. Many here said they'd taken the last train out of East Germany. East German officials suspended visa-free travel to Czechoslovakia today, effectively shutting the border. The first trains are expected to leave Prague in the next few hours for West Germany. This is Deborah Amos reporting from Prague.
Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa today was invited to address a joint meeting of Congress as Senate and House Democrats announced an ambitious effort to help Poland and Hungary make the leap from communism to democracy. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 40 points to close at 2754.37. This is NPR News. The House of Representatives today approved legislation restricting government grants for art considered to be obscene. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
The restriction was part of a compromise worked out last Friday by a House-Senate conference committee. It was much milder than the limits proposed by Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina. The Helms Amendment would have denied government money to art considered indecent or obscene, or which denigrated religious, ethnic, handicapped, or racial groups. The guidelines approved today, however, say only that the National Endowment for the Arts cannot provide funds for art which, in the judgment of the NEA, is obscene and which lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value, language which echoes the Supreme Court definition of obscenity. The legislation also calls for a panel to be appointed to study the NEA's grant-making procedures and to decide if there should be stricter standards for art supported by the government than for privately financed works. I'm Ina Jaffe reporting.
The House today voted to support a measure reimposing the so-called fairness doctrine on broadcasters that requires them to provide airtime for conflicting views. The measure was part of a budget reconciliation bill, and the House voted 261 to 162 against removing it. The fairness doctrine was enforced by the Federal Communications Commission until 1987, but the FCC voted then to abolish it after former President Reagan threatened to veto legislation that would have codified the doctrine. The federal government has approved a drug today to treat schizophrenia patients, not helped by other medications. Officials have decided the drug's benefits outweigh toxic side effects. The Food and Drug Administration emphasized that clozapine is not a cure for schizophrenia, the mental disorder which a person loses touch with reality. Clozapine was evaluated first in the early 1960s, but its development as an antipsychotic drug was largely abandoned in the 1970s. I'm Frank Stachow in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In a recent New York Times interview, novelist Russell Banks said he comes from people who viewed success as a criticism of their life. Moving up and into the world of ideas was a betrayal. Russell Banks has moved away from his working-class New England background, but he keeps returning in his fiction. Banks' new novel, Affliction, deals with a recurring theme in his work, male violence. Affliction is a portrait of two sons of an abusive alcoholic father. Banks says he's trying to understand the consequences of having been beaten by his father. The novel asks if it's possible to break the chain of male violence. Banks grew up in Barnstead, New Hampshire. His father was a plumber, his grandfather was a plumber, and in the early 60s, he was a plumber too. In a review of Banks' previous novel, Continental Drift, James Atlas wrote that Banks' ability to evoke the texture of American life rivals John Updike's. The new novel, Affliction, is narrated by Rolf Whitehouse, who tells the story of how his brother Wade turned into a man even more violent than their father. Rolf says he is telling his brother's story because it is Rolf's ghost life, and he wants to exorcise it. I asked Russell Banks if writing the novel was a kind of exorcism for him.
I think so. I guess I won't really know for another couple of years when if I find myself driven to come back to the same story in some way again, because I've tried to tell the story a number of ways, a number of times over the years, and I think I finally got it told. The story being, the story of domestic violence and that context for a life, family life, and also the story being the story of the perpetrator rather than that of simply and narrowly the victim, which I think is only half the story.
Mm-hmm.
The whole story isn't really told, I don't think, until you can tell it from the point of view, or at least until you can enter the mind of the perpetrator, of the oppressor, I guess. Because it's so systemic, it's part of a larger system than just a good guy versus a bad guy.
I'd like you to do a reading from Affliction, and this is a scene in which the father who beats his wife and his children is confronting his son, and the son has to figure out what to do. And this is the older son in the book, Wade.
Yeah, Wade is the protagonist really of the novel, and we're dealing with him as an adult for the most part, for 2 weeks in his life really. But this scene, and it takes place when he's about 16 years old, it's really his part of his essential childhood. His father has he's tried to confront his father in the middle of a quarrel between his father and mother, and the father says, "You're telling me, you are trying to tell me what I'm supposed to be afraid of. You think I'm afraid of you?" He showed his large teeth and made a quick move toward Wade. And when Wade jumped, he stopped and folded his arms over his chest and laughed. "Jesus H. Christ," he said. "What a candy ass." Without thinking it, Wade reached behind him into the dish rack, and his hand wrapped itself as if of its own volition around the handle of the skillet, heavy black cast iron, and he lifted it free of the rack and swung it around in front of him. The sound of his heart pounded in his ears like a hammer against steel, and he heard his voice, high and thin in the distance, say to his father, "If you touch her or me or any of us again, I'll kill you." His father quietly said, "Jesus." He sounded like a man who had just broken a shoelace. "I mean it. I'll kill you." He lifted the skillet in his right hand and held it out and just off his shoulder, like a ping-pong paddle, and he suddenly felt ridiculous. Without hesitation, Pop walked quickly around the table, came up to his son, and punched him straight in the face, sending the boy careening back against the counter and the skillet to the floor. Grabbing him by his shirt front, Pop hauled the boy back in front of him and punched him a second time and a third. A fourth blow caught him square in the forehead and propelled him along the counter to the corner of the room where he stood with his hands covering his face. "Come on," his father said, and he advanced on him again. "Come on, fight back like a man. Come on, little boy, let's see what you're made of." Wade yanked his hands away and thrust his face open-eyed at his father and cried, "I'm not made of what you're made of," and Pop hit him again, slamming Wade's head back against the wall. Wade covered his face with his hands once more, and he began to cry. Pop turned away in disgust. "You sure ain't," he said, and he walked over to the door, where he turned back to Wade and said, "Next time you start telling your father what to do and what not to do, make damn sure you can back it up, buddy boy." Then he went out, slamming the door behind him. Wade let himself slide slowly down to the floor, where he sat with his legs straight out, his head slumped on one shoulder, his arms flopped across his lap, a marionette with its strings cut.
Well, it's a terrific scene. You know, the two brothers in this book, one of them, Wade, who is in the scene that you just read, decides to fight back at some point, whereas his other brother, his younger brother, Ralph, learns to hang his head in shame and back away, something he learned from his mother. When you were growing up in a family with an abusive father, did that seem like the two alternatives, to hang your head in shame and back away, or to learn how to fight back?
Yeah, I think that, for a boy, that's certainly the two alternatives, because you can imagine, and you internalize early and then later put into action that fantasy of revenge, of fighting back. And Wade's taken that route, despite its destructiveness in his life. And then, or you can run. You can be the denier, in a sense. You can cut yourself off from others and remove yourself from family or community and all forms of intimacy, like Rolf, the narrator of the book.
Which did you do?
Well, in a sense, I did both, I think, at different stages of my life. When I was very young, I mean, when I was in my late teens, early 20s, and so on, I was one of those turbulent, violent young men, always on the edge of exploding, and oftentimes actually exploding, a barroom brawler kind of person that society has kind of mixed feelings about. On the one hand, he's often attractive and the hero of a lot of films and television specials and so forth. On the other hand, he's a repugnant and a chaotic individual. And then later, I think I went through a period of my life where I was distanced and detached and protected myself and protected others through that.
Mm-hmm. Novelist Russell Banks is my guest, and we're talking about his new novel, Affliction. Is the scene that you just read a scene from personal experience?
Well, to some degree. In terms of the boy wanting to defend his mother and understanding his role in the family as that was certainly something that I experienced emotionally and situationally, not necessarily the same age or exactly the same circumstances, and then failing to be a man, as it were, in those terms that the father was defining, to rise to that occasion, failing to become that person. So that's the essence of that scene, is that the challenge is thrown down, be a man, and to be a man he's got to fight him, and not be a victim, not just be beaten by him.
So was there a point in your life when you figured out that there was another way to define manhood?
Surely. I think that, you know, I think one knows these things. And you don't have to figure them out. It's pretty apparent what's good and what's bad behavior. But there are powerful compulsions that grow out of this situation, this context in a child's life. And the compulsions get enacted despite what you've figured out and what you know. And that's where the pain and shame come into it. Because men who beat their wives, no matter how much it gets reinforced by the society at large, nevertheless know that it's wrong, and what they're acting out of is some strange and powerful compulsion.
Rolf, the brother who withdraws, says at one point, "I became a careful adult. It may have been a high price to pay, never having been carefree, but at least I avoided being afflicted by the man's violence." But he kind of comes to realize that there's other kinds of affliction from this violence, too.
That's
which
right.
is the knowledge that you're withdrawing from life to protect
That's
yourself.
Right.
And I was wondering at what point you started to realize that, and also to fear this kind of deeper affliction, that it's something that you would carry, that in a way someone who came from an abusive family might be something of a time bomb themselves.
Well, yeah, Rolf is sort of whistling in the dark there in the passage you quoted. And part of his telling of the story is a way of his realizing that he is whistling in the dark, so that the last lines of the book, in a way, are his gradual admission that that he's still locked in some way. And that's certainly the first step toward perhaps release from the situation. My own case... it's hard to say. This is a process and a lifelong one. I've been writing about these kind of men and boys for most of my career in one way or the other, most of the time, and I think less so now, indirectly and obliquely. But as my own emotional life has become a little bit less tangled and turbulent and conflicted, I've been able, as a writer, to approach the characters and the world that they live in more directly. You want to go a little further on it, because I wanted to say that as a novelist, I have I have access to certain tools and strategies, I guess, for lack of a better word, that perhaps a person normally doesn't have, just because, for instance, memory is a crucial, a novelist tool that has to be cultivated and preserved. And so I'm forced again and again through that to go back to my own childhood. The language of fiction ends up eventually betraying you if you aren't telling the truth, and so is my attention to my craft and attention to language has forced me to perhaps, you know, to deal with the truth of the matter more than I might have otherwise if I were, if I ran a used car lot or if I were a lawyer or something.
I want to ask you about the narration, the way
right.
you chose the narrative structure for the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of complicated narrative structure in the sense that it's narrated by the withdrawn brother.
Mm-hmm.
Who's telling the story of his older brother, the brother who becomes violent himself.
Mm-hmm.
And so the story we're reading is primarily the story of the older brother as told by the younger brother, but we sometimes almost forget that the younger brother's telling it because
right.
we're seeing it so much through the eyes of the older brother. Surely there would have been a simpler way tell me why you chose this kind of
structure.
It
might have been a simpler way, but then it might have also misled or misrepresented the... I should say, in any other way to tell the story wouldn't have been able for me to have told the story. I told it this way because the particular story seemed to demand it. It's not as complicated as it might seem. Partially, I think we're in a way over the last decade or so as readers in America, anyhow, have been seduced by the power and brilliance of a lot of writers' work. Mostly what are generally called minimalist writers, into a fairly simplistic idea of what a narrator is or can do. And we've forgotten that the tradition of realism in fiction is much wider than that. And my narrator is essentially the same kind of narrator that Melville uses in Bartleby the Scrivener. It's a guy telling a story about another person, and in the process of telling the story about this other person, comes to a deeper understanding of himself and his connections to the other person.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your new novel, Affliction, but first we're going to take a short break. Novelist Russell Banks is my guest. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Novelist Russell Banks is my guest. His new novel is called Affliction. He's also the author of Continental Drift. You know, by writing a novel that everyone will assume is at least partly autobiographical about family abuse, domestic abuse, you know that when you're interviewed, you're going to be asked about how much is autobiographical and about violence in your family and everything. And I'm wondering if... When you decided to do interviews about the book, if you felt comfortable with that, especially with us interviewers, you know, we always try to make connections between the life and the work, and you know, I don't know if you feel like just because you're writing this book that you have to come clean about everything that's happened in your life, go public about everything.
And I, believe me, I won't. But but I think that yes, I know that. Even if you write a book that's about Martians, people will ask you about that connection between the author and the fictional characters and so forth. And the standard response is, I think, the reasonable one, which is there's no connection whatsoever. I just made it up, as it were. But and I know, though, with a novel like this and so forth, it's more likely to invite it. I have gone ahead and acknowledged in numerous places that there are real connections between my own childhood experience and the experience of Wade Whitehouse and Rolf Whitehouse for a couple of reasons, when I would just as soon, frankly, say no, none whatsoever. I just, you know, read about it in the papers. I guess because I think, and this in some ways separates me as a writer from the book, and just talks about, I don't want to talk about it then, just as a man who happened to come up in a family that was marked by violence. I think that it's probably a useful thing to do, to come out and say it and admit it and say that, yeah, this happened to me, and I went through a long period of my life where I was ashamed, and that the shame is one of the ways in which you continue that syndrome. And the loneliness and alienation that you feel because of it is one of the ways in which it perpetuates itself. So by speaking of it and conceding that, you know, this occurred in my life, I think I'm also in some way contributing to breaking down that syndrome a little bit. I think if more of us did it, I mean, these things, afflictions of this sort, sexual abuse, violent domination of people by each other in a family and so forth, are perpetuated and fed by secrecy and silence. So I don't know how else I could respond to the questions without saying, yeah, you're right, it did happen to me. And I didn't die, you know. And it caused a great deal of pain and confusion in my life and in the life of people close to me. But in time, I managed to, I think, break that syndrome.
Unlike the father in your novel who outlives the mother, your father left the family when you were 12. Do you feel in a way lucky that he did, so that you and your mother were no longer exposed to his violence?
Well, certainly it when you remove the key figure in the family, you break the syndrome, but you also break all other kinds of relationship down in a way. When he left, we also lost our father, and lots of other aspects to his life were gone from our life, and so we then became, my mother in a sense became one of these single parents with four small children. I was the oldest at 12, and so there were other kinds of consequences. So I couldn't say it was a good thing. What happened, I think, was just a dysfunctional family became dysfunctional in another way at 12. My relationship with my father had a a blank that went from age 12 till about 18 when I reestablished contact with him and reconnected to him and spent the next decade or so of my life in some ways trying to come to know him and to know myself in his world. I wasn't, you know, without a father.
I want to read a sentence from your novel that I particularly like. Wade was the third child in a taciturn family that left children early to their own devices, as if there were nothing coming in adult life worth preparing them for. Hmm. Is that the kind of upbringing you felt you had? I like the sentence a lot. I like the way you describe that.
I don't think that I had that kind of upbringing altogether, no. No, that's a little grimmer than I had. I think, though, I'm taking something that I know firsthand to some degree and also having witnessed it in other lives. I'm talking about lives with low expectations and people who, in a sense, don't respect their childhood because they don't believe that their lives can ever amount to anything anyhow.
The novel's set in a small town in New England, and you describe it as the kind of town that people leave but that no one comes back to. And the character who's narrating this describes how he hates to go home on the holidays and that he has to be coerced into it by guilt, tricked, if not by himself, then by the wider sentimental culture.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. And I was wondering what you were thinking of when you were thinking of the wider sentimental culture. You know, and tricking someone like him to go home to this small town he was so happy to escape.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think he says that he especially doesn't like to go home on the holidays. And I think that this is the song, Home for the Holidays, and White Christmas, and all our associations with holidays, I think, are manipulative and deceitful in some way. Especially for those of us whose families don't correspond to that family that sits around the loaded board in a kind of golden haze, cheerfully having just opened up all their wonderful Christmas gifts and so forth. The wider sentimental culture seems to obviously creates and perpetuates and then finally exploits a myth of family that doesn't really exist except in, you know, our dreams, and so that most of us go through lives feeling that our families are somehow exceptions and failures, and these cross patches that we spent our childhood are inadequate and shameful failures.
I want to quote something that you said in the recent interview in the New York Times. You said, "I came from a people who viewed success as a criticism of their life. Moving up was a betrayal of the family." How was that expressed to you? I mean, how did you pick up on that?
Well, for instance, my father never understood why it wasn't good enough for me to be a plumber as he had been. And he was a man who felt deeply frustrated and cut off. He was a very bright young boy, and he graduated high school at 16. He was even precocious, had a photographic memory, great musical talent and so forth, loved music. And yet he had spent his life, in the trenches with the wrenches, as he used to say. And so there's a kind of bitterness about that made it very difficult for him to appreciate my rejection of that. If I reject it, then it has to look somehow not worthwhile to him, and yet he had spent his life in some way rationalizing and accommodating himself to what he felt very bitter about.
Russell Banks' new novel, Affliction, is published by Harper & Row. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Nobel Prize-winning novelist Saul Bellow. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Some now famous rock songs didn't make much impact the way they were originally recorded. Coming up, rock and roll historian Ed Ward compares now classic recordings with the more obscure original recordings of the same songs. Also, feminist writer Valerie Miner talks about crossing class lines. And television critic David Bianculli reviews the new season of Wise Guy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. After a day of conflicting reports, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said this evening, the attempted coup against Panama's General Noriega has apparently failed. NPR's Phyllis Crockett has more on the story.
According to Fitzwater, Noriega's forces are back in control. The coup, Fitzwater said, has apparently ended. The U.S. has wanted Noriega out since he was indicted in Florida on two drug charges in February of 1988. Noriega said the charges are part of a plot by the U.S. to regain control of the Panama Canal. Today, the president said the U.S. played no part in the attempted coup. Fitzwater said that today's action shows that there is opposition to Noriega within Panama and that there is a strong faction within the Panamanian Defense Forces that feels Noriega should be removed. According to Fitzwater, there is still not a lot of information available on exactly what happened today in Panama, but he says the Bush administration will continue to press for Noriega's removal. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
Tonight, General Noriega appeared on government television in Panama, ending speculation that he might have been injured. The general, wearing his usual military uniform and showing no signs of injuries, condemned the attempted coup by junior officers. Colombian drug smugglers appear to be traveling new routes through the Caribbean. The Coast Guard says 2 tons of cocaine has been seized in unusual locations over the last 48 hours. Rick Stone in Miami has more.
Since Sunday night, the Coast Guard has intercepted 25% of the amount of cocaine it seized in all of 1988. The seizures came from a bungled airdrop, a cabin cruiser, and a Panamanian freighter, all found near the Puerto Rican island of Culebra. Coast Guard Commander Jeff Corona says it shows that the drug cartels, for reasons yet unclear, are shifting their routes farther away from the U.S. mainland, and that the interruption caused by the Colombian government crackdown in mid-August was only temporary.
And this trend seems to be continuing, and it was reinforced by this.
The activity near Puerto Rico is taking place despite the presence of U.S. authorities bringing hurricane relief to the islands. For National Public Radio, this is Rick Stone in Miami.
More bomb explosions in Colombia occurred last night and then again today. More than 100 bombs have exploded in that Latin American country since a cartel-linked hit squad declared total war in the country August 24th. No one was injured in the latest explosions, which police in Colombia blame on drug cartel finance terrorists. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up almost 41 points to close at 2,754.37 on volume of some 183,700,000 shares. Advances led declines 9-5 as the Dow closed at a record high. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a comparison of some now classic versions of rock and roll and country songs with their more obscure original recordings. This is the era before the Beatles, before it was assumed that the performers singing a song also wrote it.
Originality counts for a lot these days in pop music. It's pretty much taken for granted that any band that's going to get signed writes its own material. But it wasn't always so, and today I'd like to start a series of investigations into some of pop music's little-known original versions.
I got a feeling called the blues, oh Lord, since my baby said goodbye. Lord, I don't know what I'll do, all I do is sit and sigh.
Hank Williams, the father of contemporary country music, is well known as author of dozens of classic songs, and it's just assumed that the song that rocketed him to fame, Lovesick Blues, is one he wrote himself. But what's this?
I got a feeling called a blue. Since my mama said goodbye, it seems I don't know what to do, do, do. All I do is sit and cry. Oh, no, the last long day we spent alone, I'm yearning for it, yeah.
Emmett Miller and his Georgia Crackers, a fairly obscure blackface group in the late 20s, doing the original version of the song. The band, incidentally, might have included the Dorsey Brothers and Jack Teagarden, all of whom recorded with Miller. But the issue of blackface brings up a serious point. Lately, know-nothings around the pop world have accused Elvis Presley of simply copying his black sources, note for note. The song that's most often named in this indictment is Elvis's first recording, That's All Right, Mama.
That's all right, mama, just any way you do, that's all right, that's all right, that's all right, mama, any way you do.
That, we're told, is a complete copy of the original recording by Arthur Big Boy Crudup. There are similarities, sure. It is, after all, the same song. But the fact is that Elvis interpreted the song for a non-blues audience, just as he interpreted the flip side of the record, a bluegrass tune called Blue Moon of Kentucky, for a non-bluegrass audience. Even more pronounced is this alleged act of theft.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, you're crying all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, you're crying all the time. Well, you ain't never caught a rabbit and you ain't no friend of mine.
Seemingly everybody knows that the original was by Willie Mae Thornton, but how many of the ones who cry foul have listened to it?
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
Not exactly the same thing, is it? And before I leave Elvis in this survey, I should add that despite the efforts of his manager, Colonel Tom Parker, Elvis saw to it that Arthur Crudup received credit and royalties for That's All Right, Mama, and gave him money to record an album. Jerry Lee Lewis was the next star Sun Records developed after Elvis, and unlike Elvis, he did write his own material, or rather, most of it.
Come on over, baby, whole lot of shaking going on. Yes, I say, come on over, baby. Baby, you can't go wrong. We ain't faking it. Whole lot of shaking going on.
But Jerry Lee's first big hit, Whole Lot of Shaking Going On, was actually taken from a guy named Roy Hall, piano player in country singer Webb Pierce's band, who had recorded it a couple of years before in a version you wouldn't recognize.
21 drums and old bass horn, somebody beating on a ding dong. Come on over, baby, whole lot of shaking going on. Come on over, baby, baby, you can't go wrong. There ain't no faking, whole lot of shaking going on.
It wasn't just the rockabillies who searched here and there for material. Down in New Orleans, Fats Domino was playing out a string of hits when he sang this one.
I found my thrill on Blueberry.
By 1956, he must have figured, the majority of the black audience would have forgotten about Steve Gibson and the Redcaps' hit version of 10 years earlier.
I found my thrill.
Louis Armstrong also had a hit with it at about the same time, so it was safe enough for Fats to try it again. Just to bring things around full circle and to show that it wasn't only white guys who took songs from black guys, one of the very first songs I was ever crazy about was one I was convinced was just a nonsense song. It didn't matter, though. It had a great tune, and I assumed it was by Fats Domino because he recorded it. Well, of course it wasn't. Imagine my shock years later to hear it done by Hank Williams, who wrote it.
Goodbye, Jill. Me gotta go. Me, oh my. Me gotta go. Pull a piano down the vine. My boy, spin it one. Me, oh my. Son of a gun, we'll have big fun on the vine. Jump along across Big Pond, feel it gumbo.
I'll have some more originals for you on a later show.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. Why do I sometimes feel a twinge when another woman succeeds? Isn't feminism antithetical to competition? Valerie Miner found herself asking these questions and, in response, co-edited an anthology of essays about sisterhood and competition. In her essays and fiction, Miner explores feminist, lesbian, and working class issues. Her new book is a collection of short stories called Trespassing. In the title story, two women go away together for the weekend to a remote cabin they built with their friends. After getting rid of the bats and cleaning up the wasp nests, they go to the store for some provisions. On their return, they encounter a stranger on their land.
Josie moved the Chevy into the shade of an oak tree which was being gradually occupied by Spanish moss. As she locked up the car, she saw a fat man with a rifle waddling out of the forest. He wore a yellow cap, a striped T-shirt, and blue jeans. A giant bumblebee, she thought, then warned herself to get serious. The land was clearly posted. No trespassing, no hunting. A shiver ran along her collarbone. They were half a mile from the highway here. It could be weeks before anyone investigated. Josie decided to be friendly and waved. Hello there, he was winded, hustling to meet her. Josie closed her eyes and hoped Kate would stay in the house until it was all over. I got lost, he said, nodding his whole body. How do you get back to the highway? That direction, Josie tried to calm herself. Up the road there. He looked her over. You got any water? A glass of water. I've been walking for hours. Biblical tales filled her head. The woman at the well, the wedding at Cana, the Good Samaritan. Sure, she said as noncommittally as possible. I'll be right back.
This story, Trespassing, is really about living with danger, about living with bats in the house, with wasps, with possibly dangerous trespassers on your land. What got you thinking about that?
Well, I guess that I was interested in the notion of who trespasses on whom. And having grown up as a good Catholic schoolgirl where I was always asking to have my trespasses forgiven, I wanted to kind of explore the positive aspect of trespassing, too. So In my sense, this story is not only about that particular hunter moving on to the land where these two women have built a house, but it's also about those two women trespassing in the countryside and establishing a weekend home among people who see the country as their daily existence. And it's also about those women trespassing in the wild, about human beings and the way we coexist and don't coexist well with nature.
Don't you think it's also about not being able to wait until everything is safe, because things are never perfectly safe?
Mm-hmm, yeah. And I think that that's what life is, that kind of trespassing on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. You've written that you think working class people have been ignored in contemporary fiction or portrayed as the other. How did you start experiencing that absence?
Well, I think I started experiencing it, I started acknowledging it many years after I started experiencing it. I think I started experiencing it, as most Americans do, by going through a school system in which literature about working people is not visible, and I think is in fact censored on several levels. I think there's a strong element of external censorship by publishers and reviewers and librarians, and I think there's a very severe form of self-censorship that goes on. But I guess that the way that I became aware of this loss is that I lived in England for 3 years in my late 20s, and I became conscious of working class identity, working class culture. I grew up in a working class family in this country. My mother worked in an all-night coffee shop until 2 years ago when she was 77 and she was laid off. And I always thought there was something odd about my family. I never identified it as a class distinction. But when I lived in England and started to read more literature, fiction as well as nonfiction about working class people, things started to click in that old way that feminist issues started to click. And I guess that's where I began to perceive things that way.
Who do you think are the exceptions to what you're saying in contemporary American fiction?
Well, I think that there are a few exceptions. I think that Ray Carver is one very fine exception. Tess Gallagher, who writes short stories as well as poetry, Marge Piercy, William Kennedy. But I've talked to a number of these people, and they've all told me stories that are similar to my stories of that kind of external censorship compounded by the internal censorship.
When you started to write, did you think it would be hard, as someone from a working class background who'd have stories of that background to tell, that it would be hard to fit in or find readers or get published?
Well, I didn't really start. I mean, that's an interesting question, because I think that the denial about class is so deeply seamed into the cultural psyche in this country that people like myself who grow up in working class families don't perceive themselves as working class, as I said earlier. And I didn't really set out to write stories about waitresses and construction workers and news vendors and so forth. In fact, I think that what happened was that as I became aware of my family through reflection, through a certain kind of distance, and as I became more aware of cultural issues about class by living in England, I kind of came out, so to speak, as a working class writer and began to write more stories about working people. And I feel like I should say before we get any further that I've gone through college. I have a lot of privileges my parents never had, a lot of possibilities they'll never have. And so I don't feel comfortable actually calling myself working class now. I see myself as someone who grew up in a working class family, but who essentially now lives in a pretty middle class environment, although that's uncomfortable at times. And that's one of the issues of trespassing that I'm trying to develop in the book of stories, that idea of trespassing across classes.
That's what you feel like you're doing?
Yeah, yeah. I think one's always afraid that the fork is going to drop or the accent's going to slip. Yeah, you're going to be found out.
Did you ever feel like you've been punished for crossing class lines?
Well, I think that I don't know that there's an overt punishment, a legal penalty, but I do definitely experience a sense of betrayal and loss. I think that if you grow up in a kind of family where there aren't books around, where what you're doing is perceived as alien, ultimately you become a foreigner, a kind of descendant before your generation, and you live in a territory that your family doesn't have access to, and in a way you also can't go back home. There's a way you can't reach completely back, and that is in part a psychological experience, but in part it's a very practical problem. I mean, books in this country are not distributed to working class people. It's very hard for them to have access to that material. I think there's also a way in which if you're writing, as I do in Trespassing and my other novels, about working class life, it feels almost as if you're passing on secrets to middle class outsiders, and that feels like a kind of betrayal.
I want to ask you, in your fiction, you know, you write about both lesbian and straight women and, you know, gay couples and straight couples.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you ever felt that you had to write about one or the other because audiences don't cross over that much.
Uh-huh. I'm much more interested in raising questions about sexuality than in saying that this is the right choice or that's the right choice. So I've found... the people often try to look for answers in my work, and I find that puzzling, amusing, sometimes irritating. But I'm a feminist writer, and I want to write about a variety of women's experiences. And I'm happy to be identified as a lesbian writer in the sense that, for me, that's a social choice, a political choice, as well as an emotional choice. But I feel... that I don't want that to limit my readership.
Valerie Miner, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Valerie Miner's new collection of short stories, Trespassing, is published by The Crossing Press. This is Fresh Air. Time to see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel has the answer to that question. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. And we'll be checking in on events in Panama and trying to ascertain whether General Noriega is in or out. We'll also hear about events in East Germany. The East Germans have cut off visa-free travel to Czechoslovakia for their citizens because East Germans were using the route to Czechoslovakia to enter the West German embassy there and then try to get gain admittance to West Germany. We'll also be hearing today about two new magazines, Wigwag and African Commentary. And we'll be talking with the publisher of African Commentary, the Nigerian novelist Chinua Achebe.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week brings us to the third show in the third season of the CBS crime series Wise Guy. TV critic David Bianculli looks at where the show has been and what lies ahead.
The year it premiered, Wise Guy made its reputation by showcasing two wonderful actors in two terrific bad guy roles. Ray Sharkey revived his career by playing mobster Sonny Steelgrave, and Kevin Spacey made his by playing the wacko Mel Prophet. Last year, though, Wise Guy was kind of disappointing. The writer's strike didn't help things, and the show's producers seemed more interested in casting the guest star roles than in writing them. Sure, they got Jerry Lewis and Tim Curry and Deborah Harry last year, but how well did they really use them? Don't get me wrong, even with an off year, Wise Guy was still the best drama series of the season. But my point today is that with the storyline that's opened its third season, Wise Guy is back at full strength and is providing the best acting and writing of any weekly TV drama. Undercover agent Vinny Terranova, played by Ken Wall, has infiltrated the New York mob again, but this time at the highest level. Meanwhile, there's a candidate for governor running around who, in Wednesday's episode, tells his media advisors to make the mob a campaign issue. Chaz Palminteri plays the politician.
From now on, every print or film piece we run had better have the word mob, crime, or law in it, or you're fired. All of you! This is my campaign, not yours.
The other dynamic guest star in the current storyline is Robert Davi, who plays mobster Albert Sirico. Davi, who was the villain in the latest James Bond movie, plays Sirico as a ruthless businessman but a tender family man. He even takes the time to have a heart-to-heart talk with his young son, whose schoolmates have told him that his dad is a crook.
Do you break laws?
There are different kinds of laws, Albert. Laws that are made by powerful people to make sure that other people don't take their power away. These are selfish laws. And then there are laws that nobody really makes, you know, they just exist and always have. Now, those are the important laws. And the most important law is to protect your family and be loyal to your friends. Now, I've never broken that law.
The irony, of course, is that Sirico thinks that Vinny is a loyal friend of his. Wise Guy blurs the line between good and evil and right and wrong, and that's what makes it so fascinating. That and its continuing emphasis on family. The crooks aren't the only ones having heart-to-heart talks with family members on Wise Guy. Here's Ken Wall as Vinny, bearing his soul to his mother, who's played by Elsa Raven.
It's not like it was before, Mom. I'm not confused by these guys anymore. I know exactly who they are. That's why I'm gonna play this to the hilt. I'm gonna take all these guys down and enjoy every minute of it. And when it's all over, I know I'll have given them a piece of my life. But it'll be worth it. But I know it won't ever really be over.
When Wise Guy slipped a little last season, there were those who thought it would never again recapture the energy and excitement of that first year. Well, it has. And this year, once again, it's the show to watch.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Roberta Sharrock and Allison Dufty. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with one of America's most esteemed writers, Saul Bellow, winner of the Pulitzer and Nobel Prizes. Also, we meet one of the best-known referees in the NFL, Jerry Markbright. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.